Well, perhaps we can get started. Once again, I want to welcome everyone to this session. My name is Mel Peel, and I'm on the faculty at Valparaiso University. And I'm very pleased to be here at Holden Village and having a wonderful time this week and meeting so many interesting people and hearing so many interesting things. My topic this week has been Catholic social thought. In the previous sessions, I've sort of been looking at the macro picture, you might say, looking at Catholicism generally, and then yesterday talked about what I would call sort of the great tradition, the mainstream of modern Catholic social thought as it's developed in the last 120 years or so. So kind of global perspectives and broad views, international views, bird's eye view, taking into account things like the Vatican and so on. In these next two sessions, which I think of as kind of going together, I'm going to be zeroing in particularly on a person and a movement that is much smaller in scale, but has had really a significant impact on American Catholicism, and I think even beyond that, and that is Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement. And these sessions, I think, are going to be much more, I hope, sort of interactive here. I'm going to say, tell some things about Dorothy Day, that kind of naturally spills into the Catholic Worker Movement. And then also tonight, we're showing, the village is showing the film On the Waterfront, which also picks up some of the themes of an older style of Catholic social thought. So there may be some people tomorrow who want to talk about that as well. I'm going to start off by talking about Dorothy Day and her life. Some people may be very familiar with that by now, and others not so much. I also want to read along the way some excerpts from her really quite gripping and famous autobiography, The Long Loneliness, which was published in 1952. It was actually her second autobiography. She published an earlier book that was kind of a convert's autobiography called From Union Square to Rome. This volume has really become quite a kind of classic, you might say, of spiritual autobiography. Dorothy Day is quite a very interesting writer as well. And so I'm going to read some passages from this and her writings, if any of you have come across them. Many of them are really quite extraordinary and quite powerful and quite moving. She was a journalist by training, actually, this autobiography has a kind of subtle power, I think, and is very much in the tradition, the great tradition of spiritual autobiographies. In fact, there are some ways that I contend this is partially borrowed on the Confessions of St. Augustine, although a kind of very, very different sort of version of that. So I'm going to read a few passages from that and then just show a few excerpts, a clips from a film that just came out a couple of years ago about Dorothy Day called Don't Call Me a Saint. This is mostly a sort of excerpts from interviews with her, but it'll give you a chance to actually see her speaking. They pulled up some of clips from television interviews and things that she'd done during her lifetime. I've been struck in recent years. Of course, I started studying Dorothy Day seems like a long time ago now, when she was not as very well known, or certainly not as well known. I've just been struck by recent years at many Catholic colleges, for example, The Long Loneliness is widely read. She gets cited in books and textbooks and history books on the history of American Catholicism or on social movements, especially in the 1930s and after. The American bishops in one of their encyclicals in the 1980s referred to her and Martin Luther King as examples that all Catholics should follow, which was really quite striking and shows how far she'd come from a rather marginal figure. Last fall, quite to my surprise, somewhere in the campaign, President Obama also mentioned her in connection with Martin Luther King, and I thought, isn't that startling that this person you know, now gets mentioned in that kind of a context. And when she died in 1980, David J. O'Brien, who's kind of one of the leading historians of American Catholicism, in an obituary piece, called her the most significant, interesting, and influential person in the history of American Catholicism, which is really quite a statement if you think about it, because she was a lay person, a convert, someone who never held any office whatsoever, who spent all her life living in what were called houses of hospitality after her founding of the Catholic worker movement in the inner city, and you know, sort of didn't seek this kind of influence, and yet over time, I think, had that kind of influence. So I'll just say a little bit about her life. Her life is really very dramatic, certainly her early life, through her conversion and the formation of the Catholic worker movement. And it's one of these things that, has a kind of inherent drama, I guess. What's always interested me, too, and I've realized over time, one of the things that drew me to Dorothy Day is that she is someone, in many respects, who is a kind of middle American. I mean, she was born in Brooklyn in 1897. Her father was a sports writer. And I've sometimes said, because there's this debate now about should Dorothy Day become an official saint of the church, you know, the canonization process and all that. And of course, the title of this little film takes off from one of her statements, you should never call me a saint. Because she thought that was a way that people took to get themselves off the hook. But I've sometimes thought that if she ever is declared a saint, I'm sure she's the only one who will have been the daughter of a sports writer. you know, usually the saints are these kind of exotic figures from the Middle Ages or, you know, 17th century France or something, or, you know, they have a kind of, they just seem utterly distant from any kind of life that we might live. Dorothy Day's father was a sports writer for newspapers in Brooklyn. He moved for another newspaper in San Francisco. As a little girl, she actually experienced the San Francisco earthquake in 1906, and then moved to Chicago. And her father was, sort of typical sports journalist of that era, a real newspaper man, that sort of thing. She was raised in a kind of nondescript, non-practicing, generic, non-Protestant background that many Americans of that time had. I mean, vaguely, there was Protestantism in the background, but her parents were not churched in any meaningful way. And it's interesting that even though there wasn't that kind of influence in her home, even as a child, she was kind of fascinated by religion. I mean, one of these kids who was intrigued by it, and when she would see manifestations of piety and so on, she would ask people, what are you doing, you know? And she reports that when she was a girl and saw a Catholic neighbor go down on her knees and pray, she thought that was just wonderful. And she even began attending an Episcopalian church in the neighborhood, you know? And her parents just could not, you know, comprehend this, and so on. She was very precocious, read very widely, even as a teenager. I mean, when you read the account of what the kinds of books she was reading, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Dickens and things, even when she was in her teens, she went off to the University of Illinois on a scholarship, rather ironically sponsored by the publisher William Randolph Hearst. So there's some irony there. She spent 2 years, again, at a thoroughly middle American place. There's no more middle American place than Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois. And she was very alert to the social causes of that era, the sort of the progressive era, and became aware of what she saw as the injustices of the time, as many other people were, became interested in the great movements for labor and social reform, and so on. And she also found, that she wanted to be passionately involved in the world in a way that her studies didn't seem to allow. But she also mentioned at that time, she met some interesting people while she was at college for 2 years, essentially. But the one thing that struck her about her education was that one of her professors at the time made the statement about religion, which would have been typical in some kinds of classrooms of the time, She said, it seems to me that I was already shedding it, her, that is her sort of natural religiosity, when a professor whom I much admired made a statement in class, I shall always remember it, that religion which was something which had brought great comfort to people throughout past ages, so that we ought not criticize it. But from the way he then spoke of religion, the class could infer that the strong human beings did not need such props. And so she decided that she was a strong person, and so she set out on a conscious campaign to expel what she thought were her incipient tendencies toward religion. And it's actually kind of funny. She began consciously cursing because she thought that was going to be a way to, you know, prevent herself from slipping into religiosity. It seems to have worked, anyhow, for a period of time. And then she actually went off to an environment, too. She went off to New York City and entered in then, in the 19-teens, fully into what you would call the more radical, intellectual, avant-garde, poetic, social justice, radical environments of that time. And so, you know, again, part of the fascination of Dorothy Day is that she plunged right into the world of radical journalism, the Masses magazine. She knew all the famous figures of that era. She worked for a journal called The Call, which was published by the Socialist Party. She hung out with Max Eastman and John Reed, and she interviewed Leon Trotsky, and really participated in that era, and very much identifying, which you kind of recognize. I mean, it's kind of, for those who can remember this, kind of early version on a smaller scale of the sort of the 60s kind of thing among intellectuals and artists and people like that in New York City. Social causes, cultural causes, radical causes all mixed up together. But also with this, a strong element of sort of rebellion against conventional bourgeois, conventional middle class life and so on. And Dorothy threw herself right into that. But then she reports in The Long Loneliness, and others around said that eventually she always had this quest for a deeper meaning. And what should life really be for? And who am I, and what is my life really for? And she eventually began to sense a kind of emptiness in the even in the protest movement. She identified with those things and became involved in interesting ways in some of those. But she finally found it sort of personally unsatisfying, and some of the ways that the people around her were acting. And she says, I was the perfect epitome of the modern young American rebel who was absolutely intoxicated by freedom, but eventually began asking, what is freedom really for? I mean, there's nothing that Americans love more than our freedom. And she says, eventually I began to feel like the small child who says to its mother, do I have to do again today what I want to? And so she, what I want to do. Where is the final purpose? You're free, you can do what you want, you've overthrown all conventions, you can march to your own drummer, but what does that add up to? So she began to feel like a need for discipline in her life somehow, and some kind of direction, that this everyday I'm in rebellion and freedom wasn't satisfying. So her particular form of this was to declare that she was going to become a nurse. And she went to work at a Brooklyn hospital, and in those days particularly, maybe it still is, nursing was kind of where women particularly would go, and it was this kind of extremely disciplinary thing, really almost quasi-military with the uniforms and the drill and the precision. And she talks about how, you had to make these corners on the sheets exactly so, or the nurse supervisor would get after you, that kind of thing. And she found that sort of satisfying, although then she said she began to chafe at that because she loved her writing too much, and the supervisor would catch her writing in her diaries and things. But what also happened in that period is that she fell in love with a very tough guy, newspaper man of the time. And the thing about him is that he was a disciple of Ernest Hemingway's. So if you have any picture of that, sort of tough guy, very hostile to any kind of convention, that sort of thing, a disciple of Friedrich Nietzsche at the time, and so on. And, you know, if you're into Freudianism at all, I guess a kind of certainly represented a lot of the values that her father had as well. And so she fell in love with this this newspaper man, but it turned into a horribly tragic affair because they began living together. She became pregnant, and he declared to her that, you know, he could never stay with her if she had a baby, and so he demanded that she obtain an abortion and said he would leave her if she did not have an abortion. And so after terrible agonizing, she finally did do it and then returned to their apartment in Brooklyn to find a note from him that said, if you followed my advice, I would resent it even more, and so I'm leaving you anyhow.
Wow.
Okay? So that was, you know, a traumatic event in Dorothy Day's life. Interestingly enough, she does not detail that in The Long Loneliness. She actually put it in fictional form into a novel that she wrote called The 11th Virgin. She used a fictional name. And so for a long time, it was not known. This was not known until really after Dorothy Day's death, except by a very few people, that this is the circumstance that had happened very early on there. And of course, it was absolutely devastating. So what happened then was that she was absolutely in near despair, but she also had what you might call a rebound marriage. She married another man, and they went off to Europe, but of course that was simply an act to try to save herself, and that lasted all of 3 or 4 months. It was nothing. And so she absolutely hit total rock bottom. She lived in Italy for a period of time. She was at absolute rock bottom, but she came back to the United States and started to try to put her life back together. She went to live in Chicago, where she worked for another radical journal and so on, and then began to, as she says, started to, and then went to New Orleans and worked there for a period of time. And she said she began to find herself stopping into Catholic churches. Even though she, you know, didn't really know why or what she was doing, but she was sort of seeking for that sort of, you know, some kind of solace in her despair there. She then wrote this autobiographical novel, which was published, and in 1924, it was actually purchased, the rights to the novel were purchased by a movie studio, and she got $5,000 in royalties, which was a lot of money for the time. In fact, a tremendous amount of money for the time. So she moved back to New York, to Staten Island, and purchased a little cottage on the beach there in Staten Island. And suddenly there she met another man. This time he was a Englishman, a biologist named Forster Batterham. And what began happening is that she slowly says she began to feel herself recovering what she calls natural happiness. And in the Long Loneliness, she describes herself beginning to take comfort from nature and from her relationship with Forster Batterham. I'm just going to read. This is a little description, which she actually drew from her journals of the time about her life on the beach there. And what I want you to notice, I think one of the interesting things about Dorothy Day is how attentive she was to nature and to creation. And she writes about the fact that watching the ocean there and the waves and the relationship along the beach and so on was very comforting. And this is a passage, and what's very, I find very interesting, is that she uses all the senses when she's describing this. Notice how she evokes every one of the senses in this description. She's talking about sitting down along the beach, and she said, Lefty had his lobster pots out, and he pulled them in, he found lobsters and crabs. In addition to all these delicacies, he had a huge frying pan going full of potatoes, and another of whiting, which were coming in so thick that we had to carry them in bushel baskets. I was planning to salt them down for winter eating. Later in the afternoon, the wind dropped. The door of Lefty's shack stood open, and he sat there contemplating the sunset. The waves lapped the shore, tinkling among the shells and pebbles, and there was an acrid odor of smoke in the air. Down the beach, the Belgians were working, loading rock into a small cart, which looked like a tumbril, drawn by a bony white horse. They stopped as though in prayer, outlined against the brilliant sky, and as I watched, the chapel bell at St. Joseph's rang the Angelus. I found myself praying, praying with thanksgiving, praying with open eyes while I watched the workers on the beach and the sunset and listened to the sound of the waves lapping and the scream of the snowy gulls. Coffee? Lefty asked me, and I accepted the big cup from his hand and bit into a thick slice of buttered toast with fried mushrooms on top. So she evokes that beach scene, I think, wonderfully. Well, as that indicates, she and Forster Batterham, she really fell deeply in love with him. But he was also the kind of person who was, he called himself an anarchist. He believed deeply in nature and biology, was a kind of Darwinian biologist, but also looked on human society and the human institutions as just sort of hopelessly flawed. I don't know if you've ever met this kind of person, but the sort of person who just thinks of society and all its institutions as, you know, dangerous, including marriage and so on. And so what happened is that Dorothy, who believed that because of the abortion she could never become pregnant, suddenly discovered that she was in fact pregnant. And in many respects, that experience of the pregnancy and then the joy of the birth was the thing that drove her to Catholicism. She actually, again, conveys this in somewhat veiled language in The Long Loneliness. And the struggle that she had had before coming to this, to faith, was she doing this out of weakness or out of strength? In other words, she still believed that religion, as it was practiced by many, many people, was essentially used as a kind of, crutch, thumb sucker. Something to prevent people from confronting the real problems of the world. And she had really identified with all these social movements and radical movements and so on. And the churches seemed extremely complacent about these things and so on. And I think this is actually a key passage from the autobiography, because it's in a section called Natural Happiness and then Having a Baby. And she says, I was surprised that I found myself beginning to pray daily. I could not get down on my knees, but I could pray while I was walking. If I ever got down on my knees, I thought, do I really believe this? Whom am I praying to? A terrible doubt came over me and a sense of shame. And I wondered if I was praying because I was lonely, because I was unhappy. But when I walked to the village for the mail, I found myself praying again, holding in my pocket the rosary that Mary Gordon had given me in New Orleans some years before. Maybe I did not say it correctly, but I kept on saying it because it made me happy. Then I thought suddenly, scornfully, here you are in a stupor of content. You are biological like a cow. Prayer with you is the opiate of the people. There's that phrase, right, from Karl Marx, you know. And over again in my mind, that phrase echoed jeeringly, religion is the opiate of people. But then I reasoned with myself, I am not praying because I am unhappy, but because I am happy. I did not turn to God in unhappiness, in my grief, in my despair, to get consolation, to get something from him. And encouraged that I was praying because I wanted to thank him, I went on praying. No matter how dull the day, how long the walk seemed, if I felt sluggish at the beginning of that walk, the words I had been saying insinuated themselves into my heart before I had finished, so that on the trip back, I neither prayed nor thought, but was filled with exaltation. So she then, you know, became convinced that, first of all, she had to baptize the baby. That was her first decision. And When the baby was born, it was this tremendously a powerful experience. She actually wrote about the experience of having the baby and being in the hospital with a Catholic woman near her who was devoted to Saint Teresa of Lisieux. So she named the baby Teresa, and she wrote this very dramatic piece about having the baby, which was actually published in leftist and Marxist journals all over the world. So she actually got royalties from the Soviet Union for her article about having a baby. But this then brought a crisis, and this is the second dramatic part of her life, in her relationship with Forster Batterham. Because A, he had no intention of marrying her. He did not believe in marriage as an institution at all. He was willing to keep living and, you know, to call it, you know, a relationship, but nothing more. And secondly, he thought that Catholicism was the absolute, I mean, religion in general was bad, but this was the mother of all, you know, bad religions here, the worst kind of religion you could have, the horrible sort of thing. And so, you know, he told her that if she had the baby baptized, that was going to be the end of her relationship, and she knew it too. At the time she did it, she was consciously aware that you know, if she did that, their relationship was going to end, which it did after she had the baby baptized. And so he left, and 6 months later she entered instruction and herself was baptized in December 1927. In Staten Island. And very interesting because, of course, Dorothy Day was a quite sophisticated person by this time. She moved in quite avant-garde circles. She had friends in the sort of literary left of the time. She published all these things. And here she's going into the Catholic Church. And she's a very funny writer at times because she's talking about the sister who was instructing her in the old Baltimore Catechism and kind of, you know, whacking her when she would miss answers on, you know, exactly this, how the sacraments worked and things like that. But the thing was, she was convinced then that she had had to surrender her entire social consciousness in order to enter the Catholic Church. In other words, she had no acquaintance with really the social thought of the church. She said when she was baptized, she did not know really personally a single Catholic. And she was convinced, you know, that Catholicism, you know, she identified with it as the church of the poor, the immigrants, the workers, and so on. But then she had to stay distant from all these social movements. And to jump across some real time here and so on, she did move to Los Angeles and then lived in Mexico for a time. Then she came back to New York City. And then, of course, by that time, the Great Depression had hit. And so you had this tremendous upsurge of, you know, radical movements all over the country. I should say, by the way, sometimes you hear people refer to Dorothy Day as an ex-communist. She was never a member of the Communist Party. She was a sort of a Native American radical before there was an American Communist Party in 1919 when it was formed. But she knew a lot of the people who went into it later on. So she kind of belonged into the circles that turned into the American Communist Party, but she was never a communist, and the party per se was something that she would never have succumbed to, and she didn't particularly like Stalin or any of that. But anyhow, in 1933 there was a massive movement that included communists and other radicals marching in New York or Washington D.C. and she was covering it for the Catholic journal Commonweal. She did begin writing for Catholic journals and so on. But she had this tremendous sense when she was watching this parade that, you know, she should be out there. But all these people were atheists, were anti-religious, and, you know, she was now a member of the church, believed deeply in the church, and so she was completely torn along this score. And so she went to the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, which is this enormous cathedral in Washington, D.C., and she said she prayed that some way would open up for her to use her gifts and talents on behalf of the workers and on behalf of the poor and on behalf of those she identified with that would draw on her talents and be compatible with her Catholicism. And then when she went back to New York, there on her doorstep was this character, Peter Morin, who was a French itinerant peasant sort of social philosopher. Quite a character, and he had immigrated from France via Canada for many years, and he was steeped in this, in the Catholic social tradition, social thought, and he delighted in nothing more than sort of getting up on street corners and debating, you know, other kinds of, you know, people advocating every cause under the sun. And he composed what he called these little easy essays, which were these little kind of sayings that would report on Catholic social thought and so on. And so here was Peter on her doorstep. He spoke in a very thick accent. He announced that it was her mission to become the new St. Catherine of Avila, that she should organize an entire movement to revolutionize society and return it to the church, and that her mission was to publish a newspaper on behalf of Catholic social thought. And at first, Dorothy had trouble comprehending him, and she let him sort of hang around, and, you know, he just wouldn't go away. You know, she writes very funny about, very amusingly about this. But then finally, she said, okay, and she went up and found a priest and begged some money. And on May Day, May 1st, 1933, came out the first edition of the Catholic Worker newspaper. Of course, consciously modeled on the Daily Worker, which was the communist paper of the sign, the time, and May Day was the great international communist holiday. And so here was Dorothy Day and about four or five of, in effect, her friends going down to Union Square in New York City and hawking the Catholic Worker for a penny a copy. And it announced that, you know, in effect, the church, the believers, the faithful care about you and the causes, and they have a mission, and they are deeply involved in these social causes as well. And that's the beginning of the Catholic Worker movement. I'm going to stop here, play a little, just a little clip, and you'll get to see Dorothy Day herself, a few minutes of that, and then open it up for questions. We can talk about anything that you would like. I actually might back this up a little ways because there's some, you know, quotes from people before the, if I can, before the credits come up and things like that, and then maybe we'll watch about 10 minutes of this. So if this works, let's see. You know, maybe we'll just play it from here. Let's see.
On a bright, sunny day, the ragged horde paraded 3,000 strong through the streets of Washington, demanding health care, pensions, and housing for the poor and the unemployed. These were my people. I was part of them. I had worked for them and with them. Now I was a Catholic and so could not be a communist. I could not join this united front of protest, and I wanted to. Now, I was just a reporter. I could write, I could protest, but where was the Catholic leadership in the gathering of these men and women? My self-absorption seemed sinful as I watched my brothers in their struggle, not for themselves, but for others.
When Dorothy Day entered the Catholic Church, she had come from a leftist background, but she was used to working to change the world, to make a difference. And she missed that because that attitude, that was the daily bread of her friends in the left.
After the march, I went to the National Shrine and prayed that some way would be shown to me. Some way would be opened up for me to work for the poor and the oppressed. When I got back to New York, there was Peter Morin.
He was waiting for her at the home of her sister-in-law on the Lower East Side. He had been a Christian brother for a while, but he was an autodidact. He had read widely in the fathers of the church and the scriptures. And suddenly here was this new world open to her.
He had been a teacher in France, although he was brought up a peasant on the land. And he had wandered around the United States working. So he suggested this program of action, which included a paper, first of all, and then the setting up of houses of hospitality as direct action.
Peter, he had this vision all the while of the Catholic worker. And he waited to find someone who would put the show on the road, as it were. And people directed him to Dorothy.
Peter was voluble, kind of a wandering soul, and a kind of born teacher and all that, and determined to teach Dorothy.
He had learned never to breathe between sentences. The chance, he tried to break in. He would hold up a finger and fix you with a glittery eye.
And it showed her humility, that she was willing to sit down and listen to this man and learn from him. And she remarked, he would talk you deaf, dumb, and blind. And he would. Peter was a character, absolutely a character. He loved nothing better than to stand up on a soapbox and recite his easy essays. Chant them, really, with a very strong accent. The world would be better off if everybody was better instead of being better off.
And he'd give you his last pair of pants if you needed them. He would quote St. Basil, "The coat that hangs in the closet belongs to the poor." And that is a very profound thought, because it's not just the works of mercy, what you give out of the goodness and sweetness of your heart, out of compassion, but it's justice.
And a work of mercy is something not extraordinary, it's very ordinary, but you're doing it for a different motivation. You don't expect to be paid, you don't expect a thank you. You just do it as a gift.
We were in the third year of the Depression. No smoke rose from the factories. Mortgages were being foreclosed. Red lines of listless men wound along city streets. It was for these people and their plight that we created the Catholic Worker in May of 1933. The paper was planned, written, and edited in the kitchen of a tenement on 15th Street. There was no overhead in the way of telephone or electricity, and no salaries were paid.
Everybody would gather from all over the city and they'd get that paper out in about 24 hours. And then we'd all pile into the station wagon with the bags of mail and go down in the middle of the night and down to the post office.
We used to sell the paper on the streets a lot, Times Square and Macy's, or 14th Street, and there'd be someone on the next corner selling the Daily Worker. And we would say, read the Catholic Worker daily.
I remember going to the printer, and as soon as we got there, the printers would come and say, "Is Dorothy come?" And you could tell what respect, even though they probably didn't agree with the content of the Catholic Worker, say it was speaking against the Vietnam War. And I remember one saying to me once, "What a great writer." And so they'd seen an awful lot, you know, and to hear a printer who stops to read what's going out through his shop was quite a compliment.
I'm noticing the first Catholic Worker you had here, it could almost have been printed today, because the problems are still with us.
If your brother is hungry, you feed him. We don't meet him at the door and say, "Go be thou filled," or wait for a few weeks and you'll get a welfare check. And so that's how the soup kitchen started. As a matter of fact, we didn't start it at all. We were feeding a house full of people, but the soup line started because one of the men who had charge of the clothes room didn't have any more clothes to give out, so he began saying, "Just come in and have a cup of coffee." And so pretty soon line formed at the door.
One rather neat-looking guy told me that he had spent time in jail for murdering the Iceman, who was making a pass play for his wife. He grabbed the Iceman's hatchet and cleaved him through the brain. Oh, it was a shuddering thought. And we had a long conversation. So you could meet people like that on that red line.
Sometimes there was room for people to stay over. But one night, two women came, but they asked if they could stay over because they really were homeless. And in the depths of the Depression, many were really homeless. So they asked Dorothy, and Dorothy said, "Well, you can see there isn't a bit of space here at all. Actually, people were sleeping in the kitchen and so on." And so a few days later, one of the women came back, and Dorothy said, "Now, where is your companion?" And the woman said, "Well, when we left here, we had nowhere to go, and she went over to the subway station and threw herself under a train." So that galvanized Dorothy. She looked, saw that she had $5, and just a few houses down the street, there was an empty apartment, and she put down $5, and it was the first house of hospitality of the Catholic worker.
And so they just begin right there and then. Didn't wait for federal dollars or to make bylaws and set up committees and so forth. They just lived it.
One ended up nude on the fire escape outside. Things weren't going right. And eventually the whole community was just upset by it. And these people were basically told that they couldn't stay there anymore. But I remember that that they came back at Easter time. They came back to have a part of the meal. And everybody welcomed them and allowed them to be there. And I thought, this is that teaching of forgiving 70 times 7.
There were days when everything was peaceful. No drunkenness, madness, quarreling. Sometimes the house is like the reception ward at Bellevue Psychiatric. One could only bow one's head and pray.
Peter used to call them ambassadors of God, and I took that right in. And of course, that's a hard lesson when there's alcoholics and very, very sick and old and disagreeable people.
Not a week passes when there have not been knives drawn, the naked face of hate shown. But then there are days when suddenly there is laughter, and one feels men have been wooed out of their misery for a moment by a sense of comradeship between the young people serving and those being served.
It's often been said that feeding a soup line is like putting a band-aid on a cancer. The thing to do is change society, but meanwhile, what about every poor human being that's hungry? It's needs a place to sleep. You have to think in terms of the present moment. You have to do things that come to hand, and scripture directs you along those lines, most certainly.
But when the city of New York, the greatest, richest city in the world, goes ahead and has to bring in the poor little woman who is covered with lice from head to foot, from sleeping out in filth and broken down buildings, with some loathsome stores, and to be here very indelicate, a prolapsed rectum, covered with filth of excrement, urine, and bedhead lice and body lice, and came and brought it to us, the police, the Brooklyn police. This is how extreme you can get. This happens over and over again in the history of the Catholic Worker.
The reason they want to make all these laws and get homeless people off the street, at the core of all the rationale is we despise poverty. What's funny about it is the people who have actually been there, the people who have been on the bottom, who, you know, who have experienced the worst of the worst, we're the ones who despise it the most.
She loved the quotation Dostoevsky, Brothers Karamazov, something about the contrast between love and dreams, romantic love, and love and action, which is a harsh and dreadful thing. And life at the Catholic Worker was at many times a harsh and dreadful thing.
She came down one time, and there was no money, and the house was just about, there was nothing to heat it with. And she brought a piece of coal and put it in front of the statue of St. Joseph, who's the patron of the house, and said, you got to do something. And later that day, literally, a coal truck came up and delivered a load of coal.
Stop it there. There are a lot of great Catholic Worker stories and anecdotes, and sometime I'd like to retail some of those. I mean, maybe I'll just do one, which relates to the story of the coal, because the amazing thing about the Catholic Worker from the beginning was that they thought of themselves as an expression of the whole church. And Dorothy Day and all the Catholic Workers in those days were extremely devoted to the church. From the day of her conversion, she never missed a daily mass until the day of her death. And so she engaged in all the traditional devotions and things of that sort. And yet she had this kind of amazing ability to, sort of surprise people with her views of the poor. One of the stories that Robert Ellsberg, who became a Catholic Worker, tells about is that one day, again, they were in these terribly desperate straits, and everyone was looking for where's the next, how are we going to pay the heating bill and that kind of thing. And suddenly, some well-off woman pulled up in a limousine and came out and handed over and donated to the Catholic Worker this fabulous diamond ring, just some enormous diamond. And of course, the entire group just went crazy and thought, here, all our problems were solved. And the next poor person who walked through the door, Dorothy turned around and handed her the diamond ring. And, the entire group again went crazy. And so, what are you doing? And she said, did you think that God created diamonds only for the rich? So there it went. Which has that kind of quality, I think, of surprising the rest of us. So, questions, comments, observations?
What's the name of the movie?
The name of the movie is called Don't Call Me a Saint. By the way, there is this formal movement now for canonization. She's going through the whole process, which many of the Catholic Workers are, to say the least, ambivalent about. And Dorothy Day herself always said, because people started calling her a saint during her lifetime, don't call me a saint, that's a way to put me up on a pedestal and let you stop doing anything serious. You'll just start thinking of me as a saint. Yeah.
That's what all saints say.
That's what all saints say, yeah.
Tell us why you came up with her child.
Her daughter, Tamar Teresa, grew up in the movement, and she married quite young. I think like about age 16 or 17, she was sent away to school eventually because growing up in the movement was pretty difficult. And she had quite a number of children. I'm trying to remember now. I think it's seven or eight children. And she just died, I think, about maybe just four or five years ago, something like that. And I have met two of her grandchildren. So. And she had a much more ambivalent relationship to the church, I think, and so on, because like many people then, and what you haven't picked up here is how the Catholic Worker just exploded in the 1930s. I mean, for about 10 years there, it just had this tremendous impact, and these houses of hospitality opened, and they were linked into all the labor movements of the time. And so on. So Dorothy became a very busy activist, traveling all over the country. Over 40 houses of hospitality opened, and so on. Yeah?
What radicalized her in the first place? I mean, she's a kid of a...
Middle-class sports writer. Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it was the process of, thinking about the world, growing up in that kind of an atmosphere where social change was in the air. She seems to have been very sensitive early on to when she would see, difficult circumstances or poverty. She says in her autobiography that when she lived in Chicago, she would have her baby brother, she was supposed to take him for walks, and she would walk over to the slums to see what that was like and so on. You don't want to compare it exactly, but it was sort of like the 60s in the sense, the period that many bright young people growing up were aware of those things. Now, she went further than that, I think, and you can say that she wanted the experience of identifying with that. She in a sense, I think, wanted to break with the path that she would have been on, which would have been a very conventional one. And you could read between the lines some of the business of going to New York City and going to live in a slum apartment. One of the first articles she wrote for this socialist paper was, she took the amount that was assigned for a person on welfare at the time and tried herself to live on it, and that kind of a thing. So she had that sensitivity early on, I think. And then, of course, just the other people around. I mean, there were these movements, she found herself caught up in that. She liked the people of that sort. She loved listening to Eugene Debs' speeches and things like that. Yeah.
You mentioned that the Catholic Worker considered themselves a part of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
How did the Catholic Church relate to them and their work, and how is that affecting today?
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, when you saw when they popped out in the 30s there, and here's the Catholic Worker, and what is this? And it baffled everyone. One of the things was that early on, it was known that Dorothy Day was a well-known ex-radical here, and she's coming to the Catholic Church, and less than 6 years after, 5 years after conversion, she's putting out this paper. So some Catholics thought this is the communist effort to subvert the church. They've got a kind of mole in here, and were very suspicious of it. Others, of course, some Catholic laborers and others were thrilled. It's interesting that the many of the leftists and others thought that this was the Catholic Church's move. That the Pope, it was the Pope's clever strategy for holding on to the working class. They thought it was the long range secret conspiracy of the Vatican. So unless the Vatican is more long sighted than I know, so initially, while on the one hand they were very loyal to the church, many of the bishops and people were suspicious of it, because and the other thing to recognize is that these were lay people acting entirely on their own. That is, it was not some official agency, not funded from anywhere. These were just ordinary lay folks, which in that era was quite rare, and so on. And of course, she was in New York City, and Dorothy Day always made the statement all through the years that if the cardinal ever ordered to shut down the Catholic Worker, she would. She was in complete obedience to the church. And the story goes that Cardinal Spellman, who was the cardinal archbishop of New York City at the time, who was, shall we say, a quite conservative prelate, and he would get letters saying, shut this thing down, and so on. The story is that Cardinal Spellman had always read the history of the church and the bishops who had tried to suppress saints and went down, in history as horrible bad guys. And so he did not want to end up in church history as a cardinal known for, so he would always leave it alone, much as he disliked it. So, yeah.
Was this kind of the founding of what we see today in every city? homeless shelters operated by churches, and is it around the world?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, of course, the notion of serving the poor and so on, but I, you know, it's hard to track down exactly. And of course, there were other kinds of movements as well. But some of the specific features of what they came to call houses of hospitality actually were picked up in many places. And I do think that the Catholic Worker Movement, directly or indirectly, has had a tremendous influence on that kind of thing. I mean, the sort of thing that would have seemed strange of churches going, you know, and directly opening up houses for folks like this, although certainly not unprecedented, but in this degree and with this degree of commitment and where the people would actually go live there themselves. I think that's the radical thing about this is the actual identification and living right there with them. Yeah.
We have a Dorothy Day Center in St. Paul. I wonder, are there Dorothy Day Centers everywhere?
Yeah.
Is it just named after her, or is it somehow continuing?
Yeah, of course it's named after her. And tomorrow I'll talk maybe a little bit more about the movement. Now, I have to say, I'm always in somewhat of a disadvantageous position because I actually know more about the Catholic Worker in the 1930s than I do in the, you know, 2009. So I can tell some things about it. And you know, the movement has continued, by the way. When she died in 1980, many people thought, well, it's so much an expression of her personal genius that it's going to disintegrate. It has changed. But there are, it went down quite a bit, especially during World War II. There have been up and downs in the movement, but it still exists. And now, you know, what exactly is a Catholic Worker? It's a sort of organized, disorganized movement. One of the jokes was that the Catholic Worker is an anarchist movement, and Dorothy Day is the anarch.
Dorothy. I'm wondering if anybody here has lived in a Catholic Worker house.
Yeah.
I know the Lutheran Volunteer Corps community in Tacoma, where my daughter's a member, they collaborate with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, and the Jesuit Volunteer Corps lives in the Catholic Worker House.
Right, right.
And
yeah,
and they serve together at a Catholic homeless agency.
Right.
It's two different groups.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if anybody has done that here. I did when I was in seminary in New York City in the late 60s. One of the features of that, at least that original Catholic Worker House, was that they had a very rich intellectual life.
Right.
They would have writers and poets and philosophers and so on who were Catholic or later on just leftists, you know, come in.
Anyone,
and that Sunday evening soiree.
Yeah.
And some of us did go down there for that once or twice.
Yeah. This was one of the 3 points of Peter Morin's program. Was roundtable discussions for the clarification of thought. You have to say that in a thick French accent too. But that meant, and Dorothy also was always very alert to the fact that this is a religious and intellectual movement as well as a social movement. That is, it's always linked to the mind of the church and to thinking about these things as well as to action. And again, sometimes later, for example, in the 1960s, when a lot of people came in with, you know, sort of a let's do it and not think about it mentality, that created some tensions with Dorothy. Yes.
Why Catholic?
Yeah.
Why
did she become Catholic?
Right.
Yeah. You know, I remember once when I was teaching the Law and Loneliness to some of my students, and they said, well, why didn't she just become a Methodist? I mean, it would have saved her a lot of trouble. You know.
Yeah.
I think that's a complex question, her experience with what I would call sort of mainstream American Protestantism had not been very positive. For example, the YMCA kind of controlled the student life at the University of Illinois. I think the deeper reason, though, is that she was a very powerful personality. And she felt that she, you know, in those descriptions of the strengths I discussed and so on. And so I think when she decided that she wanted to devote her life to faith and the church, then she wanted the strongest meat that there was. You know, sort of she wanted what she understood to be the real McCoy and the church that took sin and grace and confession and all that absolutely seriously and did not, you know, have any sort of truck with that. And I don't know this for sure. I do think that perhaps the sense of being able to confess what she came to regard as her sin of the abortion may have played into that. But she also identified, I think, with the Catholic Church. The fact that it was the immigrant church, it was sort of the church that was sort of despised in more respectable circles. And as I mentioned, when she would be drawn to, you know, piety and so on, she would be attracted by the Catholic environment. She loved to walk into these cathedrals and find the atmosphere there very, very appealing. So that's the closest I can come on that score on why she didn't become a Protestant. I think there was an element of rebellion against her own, you know, the sort of generic Protestant background, too. Perhaps.
Wasn't there also my parents had Catholic workers. We had them in our house. I have them from the 30s. She has a fairly strong authoritarian streak. And her, just her quoting of Peter Morin.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask about the mission societies that in the 19th century still very strong, the Salvation Army.
Sure. Yeah, and you know, there are precedents in those regards, although, again, not to get into fine distinctions, but I mean, there are differences in the ways that some of the groups approach the social questions and the social orders. And the relationship to things like evangelization, for example. The Catholic worker from the beginning sort of did not, I mean, this is the mission of the church, but there's no hint here of we're going to bring you into the church. Not at all, no taste of that. So yeah, sure, you obviously, and the concern for the poor goes, you know, goes far beyond the Catholic worker. You would not want to say that they originated that by any stretch of the imagination, yeah.
I was reading it, the book, at the time when the mobilization of the protests to, you know, not to attack Iraq was taking place. On the parallels that I was finding with the Catholic Worker newspaper, and it's, you know, not only the war resistance but other social issues, and the as I recall, the churches were ceasing to subscribe to the newspaper because
right.
a lot of the parishioners were also business owners, and so that wasn't very good for business. And it just kind of struck me how kind of mainline media also, you know, it's like, you're not going
right.
to publish articles that are going to upset the advertisers or others, and so they really served as an alternative media.
Right.
Amount of their time.
Right. Right. Yeah. And of course, we haven't touched on the pacifism, the opposition, particularly in World War II, was really the movement. You know, just nearly collapsed on that score. The circulation of the paper was 186,000 in 1939. And it still circulates over 50,000 copies. Now, of course, that's a little. The Catholic Worker is the strangest, you know, publication that exists. It still sells for a penny a copy, and if you subscribe, it's a quarter for a year. So it's the only journal that, you know, costs twice as much to subscribe to by the year as it does the individual. Its issue. It's a monthly, and they use the penny, of course, as a kind of, you know. It's a sort of giveaway. So you can't quite compare it to ordinary media, but on the other hand, it still has a tremendous, you know, for things of that sort, it's quite widely read. Tomorrow I'll send around some copies of it if you haven't seen it, and it still looks almost exactly alike, except, you know, you saw the two brawny workers on the, and Adi Bachun, who you saw in the film, was one of the illustrators of the paper, along with a guy named Fritz Eichenberg, who did the illustrations. And they're always the saints and the workers and all those people illustrated in the paper. Yeah.
Did you get in any trouble with the McCarthy era?
Well, you know, in the general population. I'll tell one funny story about that, and then maybe that's the way to end. There was the business in the 50s because, you know, they maintained their stance and were opposing, wars and advocating social justice and so on. So at some point, the Catholic workers did get on the FBI's list. So the FBI sends agents to the Catholic worker house, you know, and they're snooping around. And this turns up later in the actual files of the FBI. And what they write, they say, you know, this outfit as a subversive organization is very strange. I mean, it's just, the agent is having a terrible time there, and he says, you know, I can't figure this out because it looks like, you know, this place in New York should be the headquarters, but there's obviously some mastermind behind this named Joseph, because everyone keeps saying, you know, we have to refer to that to Joseph, or when we need something, we're going to have to go get from Joseph, or Joseph will have to stand behind us. And he said, I haven't been able to figure out, you know, who this Joseph is. And of course, it's Saint Joseph, the patron saint of the Catholic worker. So they baffled the FBI on that score. Thank you all for coming.